The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Day is it? Thursday. It started off slowly, and frankly, I was a little down this morning. I'm really tired of seeing all these innocent people being butchered by this plandemic. Plandemic. Planned to the max for perhaps decades. Now we have a new interview from a UK funeral director, which we're going to play in this first hour for you. I have only heard the first half of it, but it absolutely clarifies and certifies in my mind the concept that needs to be entertained, that the entire pandemic may, in point of fact, have involved whatever COVID is, a bioweapon, whatever it is or isn't, to a very small degree. We know they renamed last year's flu season, influenza A, influenza B. We know they renamed all of those COVID cases. We know they actually took people with serious chest colds, coronaviruses, put them in the hospital along with the others who actually had flu. They hooked them up to remdesivir, and they took them straight downhill from there. Many of them ended up on ventilators, and they killed them. This is murder, mass murder. Wait till you hear the interview. It's a stunner. My colleague Erica Kahn is with us these first 2 hours tonight. We have a lot to talk about. Erica, thanks for being here. Did you get a chance to look at that full video yet?
I've gotten through about half of it, and very, very compelling, very well done, very damning.
Oh, at the very least. Before we jump into that, let me do something else. I did get a call this morning from a friend who has a friend who used to be in the DOD. And his friend said, if you know anybody, now I do not, and please don't do this. Don't take the bait. Don't get to the point where you're completely panicked. But there is a yellow alert now for the Cumbre Vieja volcano. Now, you know, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, you know we've covered this for two decades at least. It's a volcano on La Palma Island in the Canaries. It's 6,000 feet straight up from the ocean floor. It hasn't erupted for quite some time. There were, in the last 2 days, over 4,200 earthquakes, tremors they like to call them, that the Spanish scientists have been monitoring. They're also suggesting that the magma under the earthquake is moving around. Now, I just talked again to my source and was informed that the magma pools at the upper levels of the volcano are now beginning to fill with lava, and that the actual volcano itself, that portion thereof, which we expect to potentially fall into the ocean, is actually moving. It's visibly moving a few inches a day. That's not a good sign. Now, if that happens, and the actual piece that is obviously been looked at and studied for years as being potentially able to be dislodged and to dive into the ocean, what happens? That's a very deep part of the ocean next to the Canary Islands. And that piece is enormous, and it would go into the ocean, and it would create a tsunami, which would hit Britain, France, Spain. It would be somewhat diminished because of the Canary Island chain, I understand, as far as going east goes and north, but it would not be diminished at all in terms of generating a tsunami that would head from east to west across the Atlantic Ocean, striking everywhere from Brazil all the way up to Newfoundland, all the way. And the height of the tsunami, no one knows. Projections are 100 meters, that's 300 feet, give or take, all the way up to 600 meters. I mean, it's sci-fi. So I don't want to get to the point where people are going, oh my God, there's going to be a mile-high tsunami. No. There may not be much of anything if less than the largest part of the volcano remains where it is. Let's say a small piece falls off. It'll be a smaller issue. But the potential is there, and the second stage alert, yellow, is now in effect. What do you know about this, Erica? Anything much? Now, you live on the East Coast somewhere, and we'll leave it at that. But this is something that would concern, I think, you and everybody else, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm practically on the ocean on the East Coast. So people here have not paid much attention to it, though. It's kind of an abstract thought. But it would be a concern. You know, that something of that magnitude could definitely inflict a lot of havoc I don't know. It depends on how you look at it. An opportune time. Add more chaos to an already chaotic situation.
It fit right in.
It would. And, you know, they've been talking about being prepared for something right around October. Maybe 100%. A little sooner. We'll see.
That's right. No.
You know, we've got our canoes ready and...
That's funny. What is... Now, for you who say, oh, my God, a tsunami could hit the East Coast... could hit Florida. If it's a 300-foot tsunami, that could probably make a pretty good dent in terms of crossing much of Florida, which is at sea level or very close to sea level in many areas. So I don't know. This is, again, in the realm of speculation, but it is not in the realm of speculation when it comes to the simple fact that magma is being tracked by Spanish geologists. It is moving underground. The locals are observing small rock slides. This is a 6,000-tall-foot volcano. They're seeing that, and that the actual crack that runs behind and inland from the piece that they expect to slide into the Atlantic Ocean is about 4 feet wide, and there's a video that I'll be putting up, and you can go look at YouTube and find Cumbre, C-U-M-B-R-E, Cumbre Vieja, V-I-E-J-A, Cumbre Vieja, and look for simulations, and you'll see it. There's somebody actually down in that crack, and that crack, I believe, has been tracked 9,000 feet around that that volcano, and that crack is where they expect it to split, if it splits from an eruption. So, yeah, a good time was had by all, for sure, with a 300-foot tsunami going across the ocean at 700 miles an hour. I believe you'd have, what, 7 or 8 hours, something like that, Erica?
Yeah, about 7 hours here. You know, the bigger concern, I mean, it's one thing to deal with water and flooding but we have a nuclear power plant literally on the ocean as well that would be a direct hit.
There are many of them along the East Coast who would get hit.
Yes, yes, there are.
And
that's
that
something they don't talk about in these videos, is the, you know, the devastation that would happen with these nuclear power plants.
Not one video has talked about that. You're correct. That would mean Fukushima-quality meltdowns all up and down the East Coast. The prevailing winds would push the initial outburst of radioactivity eastward across the Atlantic, through Europe, through Russia, all the way through China, India, and then looping around the northern hemisphere again and again and again, like Fukushima did, same thing, but potentially far, far worse, because any number of reactors could be lost along the East Coast with a tsunami that would impact them and take them right off the power grid, and they would begin to melt down within an hour, I would say. Not long at all. So, so you visit your nuclear power plant often, do you, and say hello to everyone there?
I don't have to visit it. I can see it.
All right, we're going to have to start a GoFundMe to get Erica out of there. Jeez. All right, that's close. As I've always said.
It's very close. And, you know, radiation travels twice as fast across water as it does across land. So it's, you know, this might as well be ground zero. There wouldn't be a surviving that kind of event if you were still here when it happened.
60-mile radius around any nuclear plant is the zone where measurable release of radioactive elements is done routinely. They leak. These plants just leak. It's a fact. I would assume that much of your air is going eastward, though, out over the ocean from that plant.
Yeah, it's north of me and probably heading towards the Azores or Portugal.
Okay. All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play a little four-minute piece about the volcano, and I think, once again, Erica said it, this would fit right into their plandemic plans perfectly. A massive worldwide shocker. Many would die. I don't know how big a tsunami would be. I don't want you to think 300 feet necessarily. I don't know. I saw one documentary that said if it was a smaller piece, the tsunami would possibly never even make it across the ocean. But if it was a big piece, the big piece that they do expect would be the one that would fall, there would be something that would hit not only the East Coast here, but Brazil, Argentina, northern South America, all the way up to Newfoundland and, I don't know, Greenland, who knows. But this is a big deal, and it would actually essentially ghost an impact of an asteroid, when you think about it. That's what an asteroid would do if it were hit in the middle of the ocean, a big one. It would generate a tsunami.
It sure would.
All right, here's this little video. It's 4 minutes. I think it's instructional. I'm doing this because there is a yellow alert now, and I think it's something your government will not tell you about until it gets to red alert. And even then, I don't trust this government to do anything properly. So I'm letting you know that I did get this report this morning from a trusted friend, and he got it from a very trusted friend who used to work in the DOD. All right, and the word was, if you know anybody on the East Coast, tell them to pack and be ready. All right, so here we go.
A slide from this mountain could kill millions of people in Europe and along America's eastern seaboard. Some eminent scientists warn that it's purely a matter of time till it happens. This is the volcanic island of La Palma, 700 miles off the northwest coast of Africa. It's a newborn baby island, barely past its 4 millionth birthday, created in the last stage of what geologists call the rock cycle. Volcanoes can form land in various ways. In Hawaii, lava gently pours from vents in the ground to build up almost horizontal layers of new rock. But elsewhere, as here on La Palma, more violent eruptions build steep-sided cones with surrounding layers of thick ash.
Showing pictures of volcanic eruptions.
Eruptions in the past 60 years have jolted this island to the core, creating a fault line, a crack you can walk through, along the island's central spine, 6,000 feet above the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, that fault line at the top ridge of this volcanic island, they're showing in this particular video, which I will post later, is wide enough for a grown adult to walk right through. It's about 4 feet, 5 feet wide, maybe 4 or 5 feet deep. It's a crack, and it runs the whole length over the top, the ridge top of this volcano. It's quite remarkable.
Eastern side of the fault, the land fell 13 feet down, then stopped. Geologist Bill McGuire and other scientists say gas pressures could build up in a future eruption and crack open the island along this fault line. They have traced the fault for at least 9 miles along the island ridge. And they believe the fault is so long that when it cracks open, 500 billion tons of rock will slide thousands of feet down into the ocean.
So it's going to go during a future eruption, there's no doubt about that. The problem is eruptions occur sometimes every 20 years, sometimes every 200 years.
McGuire paints a terrifying fantasy picture of what anyone standing on the top of the landslide would see and hear.
I don't know if anybody's heard the noise made by this amount of rock sliding against another great chunk of rock, but I always imagine it as if there are a million fingers scraping down a blackboard.
The slide will reach a speed of more than 220 miles per hour.
So you'd be hurtling down the slope of the volcano. It would start to break up into smaller pieces as it entered the ocean, but by then it would already have displaced something like half a mile of water, which would be towering above your head, and that would be probably the last thing you'd ever see. Spectacular way to die.
McGuire believes the impact with the ocean will create a dome of water nearly 3,000 feet high.
This is a mass of rock which is probably bigger than Manhattan Island. And when it collapses, it will generate ocean-wide tsunami, which will be at least as devastating as those that struck the Indian Ocean.
The vast amount of energy pumped into the ocean will create what one scientist has called a mega tsunami. Tsunami waves racing out in all directions.
There's a very good simulation in this, and if you can't wait, you can go to YouTube and look up Mega Tsunami Scenario. Mega Tsunami Scenario, La Palma Landslide. And when this hits the water, if it's as sizable as he is saying, you'll see in the simulation.
Computer predictions suggest they could even travel 4,000 miles toward the eastern seaboard of the United States, losing some, but not all of their power along the way.
That wave will travel all the way across the Atlantic Ocean to the east coast of North America. But the water itself won't move all the way across. The individual particles in the water will transmit the energy to one another. And we can demonstrate that quite nicely on a pool table here, where the energy from this first ball I'm going to hit is transmitted through all the others to the last one.
Just as energy moves from ball to ball, so the landslide energy transfers from water particle to water particle across the ocean. As the landslide's energy approaches the coast, it builds up into a massive wall of water. These deep reds and blues are computer predictions of waves 100 feet high and more.
The level of destruction is difficult to quantify. It is going to be enormous, there's no doubt about that. If people are still in the cities when the collapse occurs, you may be considering millions of casualties.
Okay, potentially millions of casualties. So just be forewarned, keep your eye on this. We're at yellow alert right now, and that's a notable development. So I wanted to make that real clear to everyone. Anything else before you pack and leave?
No, I my go bag is ready.
All right. Okay. Enough of that for the moment. We'll stay on it for you. But again, I did get this information this morning and an update this afternoon, and it's being taken very seriously. And if those magma pools are filling with lava, as I was told, that's a very significant development that I did not hear this morning. Okay, we got the video from a couple of people, and I thank them for sending this. It's a funeral director in the UK. His name is John O'Looney, O-apostrophe-L-O-O-N-E-Y. He's a family-run business owner. He and his wife and one other person, an embalmer, runs the business. Now, I only got halfway through this myself, but I was so knocked over by what I was hearing and how it was being delivered that I wanted to share it with all of you tonight. So we're doing that. This is the interview was done by Max Eigen, who I believe is in Australia. He did a very good job. He just turned the guy loose and let him talk. And so let's go into that. And anything, Erica, you want to set the stage?
Yeah, I should mention that this. I have heard an identical story from in social media. I think we read it a while back on one of the programs. A woman had said that her husband has been a funeral director for about 25 years or so and never saw an uptick in deaths during 2019, very little in 2020, I mean, barely a blip. But right. Ever since the vaccine was rolled out, he's never seen anything
That's
like
right.
it. They're inundated, absolutely
right.
inundated.
Well, this is death by vaccine, and how many times have Eric and I said, and long ago I was also saying the same thing, that this is an issue of people getting sick from the vaccine. And all those people in hospital now who have COVID, who were their breakthrough cases, that's such BS. They're suffering from the effects of these kill shots.
Unquestionably.
Correct?
Yeah, unquestionably. I mean, and they keep adjusting the definition of what it means to be vaxxed so that, you know, anybody can fall under the category of unvaccinated, even if they've had a shot or two shots. If it's not within a certain time frame, you're considered unvaxxed. It's all to suit the narrative.
Well, I think what you're going to hear on this is going to be quite alarming. But it will be for a lot of you. Well, I knew it. That's what I thought. So let's go listen to this, and we'll pause it occasionally, take a break maybe, and try and amplify some of what is said. And what is said, again, is extremely pragmatic. It is logical. I see no reason for this man to be exaggerating, lying, or in any way fabricating. I think he's telling his whole truth. So let's go to it. The first voice you'll hear is Max Eigen. And as soon as I can get past this opening, we'll go there. All right.
Hi, folks. I just had a conversation with a funeral director from Milton Keynes in the UK. I was going to run the conversation like an interview, and then I decided, no, I'll just let him speak. And then after that, I was going to edit it down and create some sort of a presentable clip for you. But after listening to it back, I thought, no, I'm just going to play you the entire conversation in its raw form, warts and all, and let you hear what this man had to say. And I think it's extremely important, folks. This man has some compelling information that everybody needs to hear. So you're a funeral director, hey, John? Yeah?
I am indeed, bud. My name's John. I'm a funeral director of 15 years. I'm based in the UK in a place called Milton Keynes, which is kind of 40 miles.
Right? Lovely place. I've been there.
Yeah.
I've spoken at Horwood House in Milton Keynes.
Okay. Small world, my friend. Yeah. So I've been a funeral director for about 15 years now. 10 of those were for one of the big funeral providers in the industry, Co-op Funeral Care. And then 5 years ago, I jumped ship and set up on my own because I wasn't really happy with how things were being done at the Co-op following the collapse of the bank. You know, people kind of became cash cows instead of being treated the way they should be, in my opinion.
So what are you seeing now, being a funeral director? How are you seeing things over the last couple of years, mate? Did you see a pandemic last year?
Let me start from the beginning. So in 2019, I had a family come and see me who had lost a loved one. And they had lost a loved one in the neighbouring borough of Northampton. So they asked me to go to Northampton and collect their loved one. And they complained at the time that the hospital wouldn't let them see that loved one. So I went to the Northampton hospital and kind of collected their loved one. And while I was there, I asked the guys there in the mortuary, you know, why wouldn't you let this family see the loved one? And they opened the chapel doors or the viewing room doors. And there was a great big inflatable kind of blow up pandemic mortuary, I've since found out it is. And they told me there was something really horrible coming. And this is why, because the viewing room was being used by this bit of kit. And that was my kind of introduction to COVID. And that was back in end of November, beginning of December 2019. So Christmas came.
So they already had this temporary morgue and knew something terrible was coming in November 2019.
Yeah, that I saw it firsthand and was told that based on the story that I've just told you kind of thing.
Okay.
So the news broke just after Christmas and we were all told about a Chinese lab and the Wuhan wet market that had been there for hundreds of years without an issue that suddenly was an issue. The hysteria was mounting and it wasn't long into 2020 before I was contacted by the local BBC and they asked, they knew that I was a funeral director and they asked to come out and do a report around COVID. And I'd hasten to add, at this time early on in the process, I believed COVID exactly the same as everyone else, you know. I was convinced it was real. We were being told it was real. And you have to remember that if I go to a hospital and, for example, they tell me a deceased is HIV or, for example, is tuberculosis, then obviously that's something I would take very serious. And COVID was no exception. So I was kind of trying to be as careful as I possibly could. The BBC came. They brought a cameraman and a lady that spoke to me. They briefed me very intently on what they were going to ask me and told me the answers they wanted. And they asked me to dress up in full PPE. And I was a bit reluctant at the time because, you know, all funeral directors will use aprons and obviously gloves, but masks and stuff like that is not something we would usually use. I worked for the coroner for 7 years and the only time I would ever use a mask there is if I was attending the scene of a death where that deceased had perhaps been there for a while, you know, an undiscovered death. And then you put Vicks on the mask and the idea is just to keep the smell away. It's not going to protect you against anything, least of all a virus. So they got the interview they wanted, you know, and promoted the hysteria. And I kind of kick myself now because it's simply not true. Any of it is not true. So very soon into 2020, funeral directors began panicking, you know. The death rate wasn't there, though. There was no increased death rate. That we were seeing deceased that were deliberately labelled with COVID, but there wasn't any increase in numbers at all, and that was across the board, as far as I was aware. Certainly every funeral director I spoke to and every mortuary I went into weren't seeing pandemic numbers. We were seeing people that were labelled with COVID, but, you know, how deadly was that? I really can't tell you. So I had a family come and see me who'd lost a young child, and the child was six, and a cancer sufferer. So totally not related. Basically, they wanted to see their little girl, and this was at a time when other funeral directors were taking body bags and coffins to the hospital and sealing people straight in those body bags and coffins there and then. There was no dressing, no viewings, nothing like that because they could do it because of COVID, you know. I felt that that wasn't fair to those people that had lost someone via a Zoom call or standing there in a hazmat suit, you know, that just isn't fair. So I washed and dressed this little girl and gave the family time to see their child, as any decent human would. And I kind of came to the conclusion then, you know, my job is to look after people, and if that means that I fall over in the process of doing that, so be it. And I've washed and dressed everyone the whole way through COVID, regardless of whether they've been COVID diagnosis or not.
Okay, and funny that you haven't died of COVID, brother.
Well, not only that, but my wife's helped me, and I've also got an embalmer who works for me full-time, who's 55. He's a heart attack survivor, 10 years now. And he's, you know, none of us have had a day off. We're all perfectly healthy. And they've streamlined the process now where a doctor's not in attendance at death. The police are not in attendance for a death. And whoever is on the scene, rings the doctor. The doctor say, okay, if you're sure they're dead, ring the undertaker. We go straight out. And I was picking these people up, still warm, you know. So it wasn't like they were sitting in refrigeration or cold storage for a week and any virus they might have had had disappeared. You know, if they were COVID patients and they were infectious, I'm sure I would have got it because I've not worn a mask the whole time.
Not worn a mask the whole time. Nor has his wife, nor has his embalmer. Again, this is a small operation. It's a family-run business. This is really revelatory already. Wait till you hear what's coming up next. Anything you want to add, Erica?
No, that's consistent with the stories I've been hearing from people that work in that industry, undertakers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I must also underline the fact that no appreciable bump or rise in the numbers of overall deaths. Just keep that in mind. We're talking about massive relabeling of flu, pneumonias, colds, the usual run-of-the-mill reasons for people to get sick and die. Now, when you encourage that and aid and abet it and cause it by giving people remdesivir and the like, that's a whole different story. That's called murder. All right, let's go back.
Neither's my wife, neither's my embalmer. So
what are you seeing with numbers now?
So, kind of rewinding back to 2020, in March and April, we saw a brief spike for about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, where unusually the phone started ringing. And as a society, we're very good at getting people to pass away in hospital. And I would say if I have 10 collections of deceased, 8 of them would be hospital removals. One of them would be from a care home. And one of them would be either a residential address where someone's gone home to die or a hospice where people go to die for palliative care. And we suddenly had an announcement on the TV from government that they were going to try and protect the most vulnerable in care homes, and that these care homes would be the places that were hit the hardest, which I kind of at the time thought was really strange because I don't understand how a virus can attack a specific building. You know, it either is in community or it isn't in the community. And I kind of, you know, it was thing after thing that I just wasn't, they were saying that wasn't making sense on the coalface as an undertaker. So I got called every night for 3 weeks to care homes. And this was at a time when Matt Hancock, who's since been dismissed from government, had transferred all of the elderly in hospitals into care homes. He'd been very careful to label them all as COVID, and he put them into care homes. And I've since found out that at the exact same time, there was a 1,000% increase in the amount of midazolam sedative purchased at that time. And there's an extensive paper trail that documents that very clearly. Now,
1,000% increase in midazolam. What does that tell you, Erica? What would that be for?
Well, midazolam is a tranquilizer, and
doesn't it suppress the central nervous system and heart
yeah,
and breathing
it's
and
used
all that?
For, as an anesthetic, you know, for anxiety, it induces sleeping, and you know, an overdose could very easily result in death.
Very, very interesting. Okay, here we go.
I worked for the big funeral provider for 10 years who have 60% market share. And in that time, I was never, ever, ever, ever called to a care home 3 consecutive nights. You know, so for me being a small family undertaker to suddenly be called every night for nearly 3 weeks exclusively to care homes and nowhere else is remarkably... It's probably about as likely as me winning the lottery several times in 3 weeks. It just doesn't happen. It's impossible. I would hasten to add that all of those people were labelled with COVID. I never saw a doctor in attendance once. No doctor ever attended, to my knowledge. I never saw a COVID test once. I never saw an incubator or a ventilator. So there was no need for those patients to be overdosed, shall we say, or heavily sedated to be intubated, because there were no ventilators. So I suspect that thousands of people were killed, euthanized in these care homes using midazolam.
Got it. Thousands, just in his area, in senior care facilities with midazolam. This is really mass murder. And everybody involved, I know, people are not that stupid. Healthcare professionals and caregivers, they know what an overdose of a drug will do to somebody. And the rate that these people were being killed in these senior care facilities, was obviously mind-boggling to him. This is mass murder. You have to understand that. And the people involved, whether they're at the top of the food chain or down at the bottom handing out the pills, they know what they're doing. I don't believe for a second that they don't. But their boss tells them, do this or your job is gone. That's all it would take. This is mass murder.
On occasion, I did, in fact, see small files, perhaps on the bedside cabinet or in a bin, because I was actually looking for them at that point, you know, where they hadn't perhaps been as careful as they ought to have been doing that kind of thing. So that was something that was... you know, kind of raised alarms for me. And then, as abruptly as that started, it finished. And then I had a pandemic guy ring me, and he introduced himself as a government-sponsored pandemic guy. And he told me that, as a funeral director, his job was to call all of the funeral directors in the area, and he was to collate the numbers of deceased. So, first of all, he would ask me, for example, what my capacity was at the funeral home, so how many I could hold here at the funeral home, how many I'd picked up that week, how many were COVID, and how many, you know, where they'd come from, kind of thing. So it wasn't really very long. He used to call every Monday. He almost immediately started steering me, and by that the conversation would go much like, I'd picked a guy up from a care home that was in his 90s. He'd had a full life, no doctor in attendance, no COVID test. He wasn't a COVID death. It was a natural death of a guy of 95. And I picked up someone from the local hospice who'd succumbed to cancer. It was a terminal cancer patient. Both of them were instantly labelled as COVID, because the guy said, we were told they were COVID. There must have been COVID in there. We've got to put them down as COVID. Everyone, even one guy that was run over, every death possible was listed as a COVID death when they just weren't COVID deaths. And I had people coming in really, really upset, families, because they knew their loved ones had had terminal cancer. And they were terrified that I wouldn't wash and dress them because they'd been labelled with COVID. And I kind of had to assure them, you know, please don't worry, I will. And I did. I looked after every one of them and washed and dressed them all because that's what they deserved. And I was doing this kind of waiting to see if I'd fall over. You know, every morning I woke up and I took a deep breath and then crack on. And lo and behold, I'm still here, as is my wife, as is my embalmer, you know. So the year 2020 progressed, and there was no, apart from that 12-week cull that took place in care homes, and I'm very careful with the words I choose because I know that's what it was. Statistically, it's impossible to happen. You know, viruses don't target care homes exclusively. The care homes, they're full of people they're full of people that can't say no.
Yeah, they've set that up and they've brought in Azalam there simply so they could get their numbers up and claim that there's a wave, you know?
Yeah, of course they have. And the paper trail tells the story. And interestingly, I did a funeral a little while ago for a family, and one of the family members worked in the local pharmacy in our local hospital, and she confirmed, I couldn't resist asking her, did you buy loads of this in? She said yes.
Mm. Yeah. So what are you seeing now that the vaccines are rolling out, brother? What are you seeing this year?
So 2020 finished kind of November, December time, and they were widely advertising that they were going to begin vaccinations on January the 6th locally. It was rolled out in different areas at different times in different parts of the world, but we were all told the lifesaver was coming in January. And I couldn't believe it, really, because this pandemic guy, after a number of months, he actually, it's amazing how quickly you get to know someone, even with a 30-second chat once a week, and it would be, hi, John, how are you doing? Everything good? Yeah, it's still really quiet. And he actually admitted to me, he said, I don't honestly know why I'm doing this job. He said, because there are no COVID deaths and everyone's saying the same thing. That's from the guy that was speaking to all of the funeral directors locally. You know, you tell me, that guy said that to me personally. So he was being sincere. And shortly after they began vaccinating, I was notified he'd no longer be calling. So clearly, there's no need for the pandemic guy to record COVID deaths now, because they've stopped him from doing so. Do you know? So November, December came and went. We were doing funerals. It wasn't busy. In fact, even despite the great effort they made in care homes to bump the numbers up, overall, 2020 was quieter than 2019 for death rate. And the vast majority of funerals we do in the UK are cremation funerals. I would estimate around 95% of them are cremations, and the odd 5% would be burials. We weren't up on numbers, and it was the same everywhere. The statistics don't lie. They're there, government statistics that show there was no real increase. And it kind of got to the point where I said to a few people, I began to smell a rat. We weren't being told the truth. And I said to people, I bet the death rate soars in January when they begin vaccinating. And everybody laughed at me. They said, no, don't be so stupid. You're mad. And we came back to work on the 2nd. And on the 6th, they began vaccinating, and the death rate was extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it as a funeral director in 15 years, and neither has anyone else that I've spoken to. And it began exactly when they began putting needles in arms. That was the recognized second wave, and that went on for about 12 weeks and finished abruptly the second week of April. And to be honest with you, I'd never want to see a death rate like it again. It was awful. It was awful. And they were very different this time. It was a mixture of all ages, you know, different, all locations as well. It wasn't, for example, all care homes. It was hospitals, residential addresses, mostly hospital deaths, to be honest with you. And we were finding, you know, it was just awful. That was pandemic numbers, but it was only when they began vaccinating and never before that point.
Were they labeling all these people as COVID deaths?
Oh, as many as they possibly could. Yeah, as many as they possibly could. But I suspect they were vaccine injury deaths, the vast majority of them. Or perhaps overdoses of midazolam. Or perhaps also a contributing factor is the blatant neglect of people. You know, a lot of families that I've got are telling me their loved ones have died from cancer and they've only managed to present at stage 4 because nobody will see them. They're not going for scans anymore. They can't get an appointment. They're being fobbed off with Gaviscon. When they've got pancreatic cancer, you know, and stuff like that, and it's just not being looked at.
Okay. The majority of the deaths were vaccine injuries. The same thing is happening right here, right now, and around the world as well. The people who are in hospital now, allegedly with breakthrough cases, who have been vaxxed, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of those in there are just bystanders, but those who have been vaxxed are in hospital now. They're not suffering from the Delta variant or the Mu variant. They're suffering from vaccine injuries. They're being sacrificed. This man has just described to you, in his own part of the world, mass murder. And I just want to submit again that this kind of death rate, this number of instantly these people were dying from the vax, can't happen without the complicity, willing or otherwise, of many people in the healthcare field. They should have stood up and said something. They didn't die of comorbidities. These people, unlike the earlier in his interview, died from the vax. And he knew it, and he just said it. This is what's going on here, Eric, as we both well know and our listeners know. People are being killed. Slowly, more quickly. Some die in the damn chair when they've gotten a shot. They die in the chair while they're sitting there waiting for their 10 minutes to go by or whatever it is. And now we've got kids. It boggles my mind. I do think that the number here of dead in the U.S. is at least 1 million now. And I've got a story going up this evening that you can take the so-called Weyers numbers and multiply them by 100, and you might be close.
Yeah, that's not too far off. The tragic thing, though, is that there's still people in I would call it a stupor, who are believing that the vaxxed are getting sick because of the unvaxxed. In fact, I there's a Fox News headline that says, Illinois family blames unvaccinated in obituary after vaccinated woman dies from COVID-19.
They put it right in the obituary.
I've seen a few stories like that. It's,
yeah.
And there
That's
it is
hate.
In print.
That's hate. And those people will never change their mind, in all likelihood, and they will continue to hate the unvaxxed. So the mental mind control efforts to make the unvaxxed the villains is working to a degree. That's pretty telling, that. Anything else?
Well, I just, you know, it amazes me that people don't question the vaccine at all. I mean, people that are so ready and willing to blame the unvaxxed, that they have no idea what's in that needle, what's coming through that needle. And they have this blind faith and trust in their government and Big Pharma.
And the TV.
And the TV.
MSNBC, CNBC, CNN. They trust it. I was in a store today, standing next to a pharmacy, and there were people there. And I heard a woman say behind me, well, when can I get my injection then? The guy at the pharmacist would say, well, we're out of Pfizer right now, but we do have Moderna. And she said, well, when are you going to get the Pfizer? She was kind of loud. When are you going to get the Pfizer in? He said, well, I don't know. It's supposed to be on the way. And, well, that's the one I want. And this lady was, well, I don't know, 70 maybe, late 60s, very thin, short hair, white hair. And absolutely, and this pharmacist, unless they are really truly the walking dead, they know what's going on. They know there are vaccine injuries, and they yet stand there every day and inject people, and they're killing them. They're killing people right there. And I looked at that woman, and I said, Jesus, should I go over there and say something? And I didn't. I wanted to for a moment, but I didn't.
I did hear a story recently, and this was a pregnant woman, a young pregnant woman, who pursued the vaccine, went to her local pharmacy, and asked to be vaccinated. And I think the pharmacist might have tried to educate her a little bit, that maybe she ought to think about this. You know, it hasn't been tested in pregnant women, this, that, and the other, but this pregnant lady was insisted on having it, so the pharmacist agreed. But I don't know if she did this on purpose or not, but when she went to inject the patient, the needle kind of missed, and much of what was in the vaccine, or the needle syringe, trickled down the person's arm. And so she objected to it, said, wait a second, you know, most of this didn't go in all the way. And the pharmacist said, no, don't worry, you got plenty. And she left. And so this woman was wondering, you know, should I go back and ask for a second dose, or do you think I'm fully vaxxed, you know, having had only a partial injection? But I think, you know, the pharmacist may not have really wanted to inject a pregnant woman with this experimental gene therapy.
Boy,
so I think there are some out there with a conscience, yes. Possibly.
Yes. Yes, that's a very good point. I wish people would, not you, but everyone, should that label of therapy should be discarded. It's gene damage is what it is.
It's manipulation.
Genetic manipulation, correct. Yeah. Now, what you raise is a very good point. And I wonder if, I know, if I were a doctor and I were well informed, and I would be, and somebody came in to get a shot in my office or wherever I was in a clinic, and this person comes in, and let's say the person's 80, whatever, up there, a senior citizen, I would probably end up giving a lot of them saline. I couldn't do it.
I
like
know.
You say, I have that person may have a conscience. I have a conscience. You have a conscience. Most of you listening have a conscience. I think there are a lot of merciful people out there who are using saline if they can possibly do it and just not saying anything to the victim. I mean, could you seriously, ladies and gentlemen, go in day after day, like a lot of these nurses do, injecting people with something that you might have a slight idea that might be really bad for them? I couldn't do it. A lot of them can.
What's disturbing, I guess, or alarming is these video clips you see of these vaccination sites where they're, you know, people are walking in casually and getting a vaccine in a casual situation, and a lot of times they'll faint or die on the spot, and the staff doesn't appear to be alarmed.
They just drag them out.
Go about propping them up or putting them on a stretcher and removing them, and it seems like it's routine business.
I saw one where they dragged the person out. Correct. This is really not like, 2% are having serious reactions. This is big. And we don't know how many in the total pool of vaxxed are actually getting formally placebos. We don't know. We think it's substantial. Erica thinks it might be up to 50%. We don't know. That's probably changing now with the boosters, though. They may be coming in to clean up those they let slide on the first go-round. Don't know. But they can't have people out there saying, yeah, I got the vax and I'm fine, if they're not fine. So that's how they do it. I think the whole thing is a rigged game. They haven't missed a trick. Hold on a minute. We'll come right back with more of this interview with the... This is about where I stopped, so I'm looking forward to the second half. This is what happened in the UK. It happened here, it is happening here, and it is happening around the world. We'll be right back. Hold on.